There's incredible untapped power in our communities. And I'm convinced it's the only way we're going to deal with climate change and a lot of the other big issues facing us. How refreshing to have locally elected officials realize that democracy is one of their functions.
Welcome to Habitat. I'm your host, Erica Butler, here with you for the next hour of conversations about how we live in our environment. Not so much a conversation today, but we are bringing you a recording of a talk that I went to this week. It was a talk put on by the Planning and Design Center. They brought in Jim Deers, who is a community planner from Seattle. He was, at one point in his career, the director of the Department of Neighborhoods in Seattle. And a lot of what he talks about in his talk is the work he did in the Department of Neighborhoods. A pretty unique department in terms of city planning. The Department of Neighborhoods helped put into place things like mini city halls in communities where they had like small storefront offices that were sort of the entry point for all city services, many of them throughout the city. Right in people's neighborhoods, with community support people working there who could help citizens hook up with all the various resources that the city had to offer. Another major thing that the Department of Neighborhoods did in Seattle was create something called a Neighborhood Matching Fund. It started as a small pot of money, and it grew bigger over the years. But neighborhoods, citizens, neighbors could get together, pitch a project. If they could come up with some resources to put towards it, the city would then match with some funding. And this kickstarted all kinds of amazing projects that were thought of and created by the citizens of Seattle. I guess one of the things that Jim Deers, you'll hear him tell it in his talk in a minute, is that what this unleashed was a lot of creativity, a lot of creative problem solving, a lot of grassroots effort, and a lot of ownership over people's neighborhoods. Neighbors started to take pride in and have a sense of responsibility over their own environment. A really refreshing angle on urban planning, I think, which is, the idea that instead of always just sort of looking towards the powers that be to solve the problems that you have, actually taking a look, amongst your neighborhood and your community to actually try and solve problems. So anyway, without further ado, here is Jim Deers.
It's great to be here. Yeah. And I hope I'm not here too much longer. I'm supposed to fly out tomorrow, so I'm getting a little worried. But anyhow, I've had a great couple days. Yesterday, I did a talk with civic leaders about neighborhood planning. I did a whole workshop this afternoon for 4 hours about how do we build broader and more inclusive community organizations. And I can talk more about some of that during the question and answer period. But what I thought I'd focus on tonight is government-community partnerships. How do we move towards that partnership and use Seattle as a case study? So that's my plan. How many of you been in Seattle?
Yeah.
All right. Go Seahawks. Yeah. So here's Seattle most people know, with the Space Needle, Mount Rainier, tallest mountain in the contiguous United States. A lot of people know Seattle from the Pike Place Market, where they throw the salmon. A lot of people know Seattle from Starbucks. Sorry about that. So, we got much better coffee in Seattle, believe me. A lot of people know Seattle is the home of Bill Gates and Microsoft. A lot of people know Seattle as the home of Boeing airplanes, which I'm hoping to catch tomorrow. But what I love about Seattle, and what most people don't see as tourists, are our neighborhoods. We've got a really strong sense of neighborhood in Seattle because of our topography. The hills, the valleys, the water create really distinct places. Usually each neighborhood has a business district in its center, an elementary school, often with the same name as the neighborhood. And has a history of active neighborhood associations, grassroots organizations. People really identify with their neighborhood. And each neighborhood has its own distinct character. So this is one neighborhood. This is Pioneer Square, one of our historic neighborhoods. This is our Floating Homes Association. For those of you who saw Sleepless in Seattle, that's where that was filmed. It's a neighborhood comprised of floating homes. This is our Capitol Hill neighborhood, neighborhood business district, typical neighborhood business district. And this is just a typical house in the Ballard neighborhood. Well, this particular house is lived in by a woman who was 85 years old. She'd lived in this house most of her life. A developer owned the property around her and said, "I'd like to buy your house so I can tear it down and put in a large new development." She said, "I'm not selling." The developer said, "But I'll give you $1 million for that house." Her house is worth $150,000. She said, "I'm still not selling. My community is worth more to me than $1 million. She was an absolute hero in her neighborhood. How did the developer respond? This is kind of an extreme example, but it's what was happening to Seattle in the late 1980s, where we had more and more people moving to Seattle to enjoy the wonderful environment we have, much like you have in Halifax. And the process, we're totally screwing it up. Getting more and more ugly apartment buildings in single-family neighborhoods, changing the character of the neighborhoods. More issues with parking, more issues with traffic. People felt like the city government wasn't being responsive for them, it was responsive to developers. And so, increasingly, all over Seattle, our active neighborhood associations were becoming more active. It was great for business. I was a community organizer at the time, in the tradition of Saul Alinsky and Barack Obama, organizing communities, low-income communities for power. And so we had no problem organizing demonstrations against City Hall. But all over Seattle, neighborhood groups were becoming increasingly active. Some of it was around the changing character of our neighborhoods, and some of it was around increasing issues around violence and gang activity, drug activity. And people were also really angry at City Hall because they said they're putting too many resources into big projects for developers downtown and not enough into our neighborhood priorities. So all over Seattle, people were becoming increasingly active, voting city council members out of office, putting an initiative on the ballot to cap the height of downtown skyscrapers, which passed overwhelmingly because it became a symbol of people's anger about the growth in Seattle. In Fremont, they simply erected a rocket on the side of one of their businesses, and they announced that it was aimed at City Hall. They declared themselves the Artists' Republic of Fremont. So in response to all that, we had some city council members that said, you know, this is no way to run a democracy, where people are seeing government as the enemy. And there were some city council members who were very enlightened and said, you know, the community could be an incredible partner with us if we gave them a chance. Active citizens don't need to be a threat. They could be a real asset to our city. There's a lot communities can do that government can't do, and there's a lot we could do together that neither one could do separately. So they had this idea of creating a Department of Neighborhoods. And there were a lot of neighborhood activists who fought for having that department. And on a vote of 5-4, over the objections of the mayor, they created a Department of Neighborhoods. Not exactly a mandate. I got the surprise of my life because the mayor called me, Charlie Royer, says, "Jim, I'd like you to be the first director of the Department of Neighborhoods." The reason I was shocked is that I'd only had 2 interactions with him prior to that time. Once was when we had picketed his house, and the other was when we released a live chicken in his office because he'd backed down a campaign commitment. So I'm still not quite sure why I got the job, if he was just trying to get me off the streets, or if it was payback because it was a pretty controversial department when it started. But what I realized was if I was going to keep that job for very long, I couldn't just train people how to release chickens in the mayor's office. We need to figure out a new way of engaging people with City Hall and City Hall with the neighborhoods. And the idea became, how do we start creating more of a partnership between neighborhoods and City Hall? How do we get City Hall to value active citizens? And how do we get active citizens to start identifying with their local government? How do we create more of a partnership? And I realized if we're going to move in that direction, we'd really need to make some major paradigm shifts in local government. And the first major paradigm shift was how do we get out of the silos that government's organized into and that every nonprofit is organized into, where we have a laser-like focus on our discipline and on our expertise and our particular function, which is a real strength of an agency, but it makes it absolutely impossible to work with communities. We've created one silo for the young people, another one for the old people, another one for the people with disabilities, and can't build community in silos. It's totally backwards. Our communities are having to organize themselves the way the agencies are organized. Who's serving whom? And where we had 32 departments in city government, each one doing its own outreach into the community around its function. In addition to that, we have our county government, our school board, our port authority. We have three transit agencies. We have our state government with all its departments, our federal government with all of its departments, and hundreds of nonprofit organizations, all trying to reach out and engage the community. They're being engaged to death. There aren't enough nights in the year to go to all those meetings. And it's not the way anybody experiences their community in silos. So in order to, for government to work with communities, they need to get, in addition to be organized in silos, need to start focusing on whole places. Start looking at how the functions come together in a place. How do we work as one government rather than 32 different departments? And how do we work as one set of nonprofits rather than everybody fending for themselves? And start with the place, start with the community rather than with the function. So one of the ways we did that is we created a system of little city halls, storefront offices where people can do business with government across all levels of government right in their own business district, where they can go in there and apply for a passport, even though that's a federal government function, get a bus pass, even though that's a county function, pay their public utility bills. They can have they can pay their parking traffic fines. If they want to argue their fine, a court magistrate makes the rounds and they have a hearing right in their own neighborhood rather than having to go downtown and risk a second ticket while they're trying to take care of their first. But the key value we have at each of these little city halls is somebody we call a coordinator, somebody who works for the Department of Neighborhoods, but it's really clear they're working for all of city government and for all of the nonprofit organizations working in that area. So they know those organizations inside and out. So if an individual or an organization has an issue, they want to get resources, their first step is go to the coordinator. So they don't have to figure out how to get through the maze. The coordinator can do that for them. And when City Hall has programs they want to take out to the neighborhoods, their first step is to touch base with the coordinator, because the coordinator knows that neighborhood inside and out. Not just the neighborhood associations, but the faith-based groups, the school-based groups, the sporting groups, the youth groups, the senior groups, all the hundreds of ways people are organized in their communities. And they also are the key person who brings all those different interests together so people can start building relationships between resident and business groups, so they can start developing consensus, sharing resources, working together as one community rather than as many separate factions. They often refer to themselves as overt double agents. Really clear, they're working for both government and the community. And their job is to help bring the two together. They're the only person in the neighborhood who doesn't have an agenda. Their agenda is to support the community's agenda, so people trust them. They're able to bring all the different parties to the table. Second major paradigm shift is to move beyond this map of our neighborhoods. And we often say that agencies, government needs needs. Right? That's their bread and butter. If there weren't needs in the community, there'd be a lot of government workers out of jobs. There'd be a lot of nonprofits out of jobs. And it's a very legitimate map. There are needs in our communities that are best addressed by government, by nonprofit organizations. The problem is we often stop there and forget about this map of the same place, which are all the strengths of the community. And I would submit that this is the map that's the basis for partnerships. If the community is bringing nothing but needs to the table, all the power is with the professionals. When the community is bringing their strengths, their resources to the table, it's a real partnership because the community is really bringing value. There's a lot communities can do where they don't even have to ask permission from government. They can just take action. One of the concerns our mayor had about having a Department of Neighborhoods, he said, Jim, the neighborhood associations right now don't represent the community. They tend to be more homeowners than renters, tend to be whiter than the neighborhood as a whole, tend to be more middle-aged, few young people. So we started up a program called Involving All Neighbors to help neighborhood associations think about how they could be stronger if they were more inclusive of everybody. And the problem in our society is that most of our population now has been labeled not by their strengths, but again, by their needs. So we use terms like disabled, at-risk youth, non-English speaking, homeless, single parent, offender, to describe most of our population. And we just focus on what people are missing, they become clients in a service system. So we said, let's lift off those labels and focus on people's gifts as a way to engage them in communities. Because you focus on the gifts that everybody has to give, they become citizens, they become part of our community. So we talked with neighborhood leaders and said, who are the people who are the most left out of community life? And they said they're probably the people with intellectual disabilities. The people who were institutionalized for years, living in major institutions outside of our city, being increasingly deinstitutionalized, living in our neighborhoods, living in group homes, living with family members, in our neighborhoods, but not in our community. Part of a service system. So we said, let's lift off that label of disabled and identify the gifts that those individuals have to give and use that as a way to connect them with community groups. So Matt here and his mom came to see me, and Matt says, I've been living in the Ravenna neighborhood for 8 years now. I don't know a person. I said, Matt, what do you like about your neighborhood? He took me to Ravenna Creek. He says, I love the creek. I knew the neighborhood is working hard to clean up that creek to make it better salmon habitat. So I said, I talked to Thomas, who was head of the Neighborhood Association. I said, Thomas, could you involve Matt in your project? He says, yeah, we can always use more volunteers. So they trained Matt how to remove the invasive holly from along the creek. And it wasn't long before Matt became the expert. And he was leading all the work parties. So here's Matt teaching everybody else how to remove the invasive holly. But Matt's greatest gift, he's got this incredibly infectious personality. So he comes and knocks on your door. He says, hi, I'm Matt. I really care about the salmon, don't you? You'll help me, won't you? You can't say no to the guy. He is the number one volunteer recruiter in the neighborhood. He's got armies of people cleaning out that invasive holly. That's his gift. He builds community like nobody else. And Matt, he's so creative. At Christmas time, he organizes a holly day party. And all the neighbors go and they collect that invasive holly, they make Christmas decorations, and then he invites everybody back to his house afterwards. And they have a big party. And Matt is totally socially uninhibited. He's always the first one out to dance floor. He helps everybody else break out of their shells. That's his gift. This on the right-hand side is Susan. She's chair of the Westwood Neighborhood Association, Delridge. She wanted to create a more inclusive association. So she worked with our Department of Social and Health Services. And she said, could you send letters out to all your clients? And the letter basically said, hi, I'm Susan. I'm chair of the Neighborhood Association. Would love to get you involved. If you're interested, give me a call. She got a call from Raymond and Ginger. She went to their house. They said, we've been living here 20 years. We don't know any of our neighbors. She looked around the inside walls of that house, and there were all these crafts on the walls. She said, what's with the crafts? They said, that's how we spend all our time. We make crafts. And a lot of those crafts had clown themes in them. She said, what's with the clown? And Ginger said, well, Raymond used to be Rayto the clown, but he hasn't clowned in 20 years. Susan said, we're having our Delridge Community Festival on Saturday. Do you think he could come down and do some clowning for us? He was so excited. He and Ginger dug through his old boxes, finally found his clown outfit. Saturday, Susan picked him up. He was the hit of the festival. The kids loved him. They started inviting him to kids' birthday parties. They started, and they invited him to other community festivals. And in the process, he and Ginger met other people who did craft work. And so they made friends. They had finally had a ride to get to the craft shows so they could sell their crafts. Susan said that Raymond and Ginger opened doors for her in that neighborhood like nobody else had been able to. And finally, this is Larry. Larry, as you can see, has a disability that makes him totally dependent on public transit. So Larry knows the bus system better than anybody else in his Capitol Hill neighborhood. He knows all the places the bus goes. He knows all the places the bus should go, but doesn't go. He knows all the places where there should be better security lighting, where there should be covered bus shelters. So when the neighborhood did their neighborhood plan, they tapped Larry to help with the transportation element. And Larry led a walking tour of the business district, pointing out all of the access problems. Because they weren't just a problem for Larry, they were a problem for elders with their walkers, parents with their strollers. Larry became so highly valued, he was elected vice chair of the Capitol Hill Community Council. Somebody with intellectual disabilities, somebody been seen as a person with nothing but needs, is now a leader in his community. Because people thought to lift off that label and focus on his gifts. Through that process, people realize the power of lifting off the labels of everybody in the community and thinking about how do we include everybody in community life again. And that's really the meaning of community. Recognizing everybody has gifts and everybody has needs. And community is about supporting each other's needs with each other's gifts. It's about mutual support. Second program we put in place to build on community strengths was a program we called the Neighborhood Matching Fund. The original idea for this program came because remember I said People were complaining because the city was putting too many resources into big projects for developers downtown, not enough into neighborhood priorities. The city's excuse was, look, if we did that project for your neighborhood, we'd have to do it for all the neighborhoods. We'd set a precedent. We can't afford to do it for all the neighborhoods, so we're not going to do it for anybody. Does that sound familiar? Yeah. So I said, for projects like that, projects have been a priority for the community but haven't been a priority for City Hall, how about if we meet the community halfway? How about if we provide a cash match from the city government in exchange for the community's equal match of volunteer labor or donated goods and services or cash in support of a community-initiated project? And how about if we make this available to any group of neighbors? So it's not for the nonprofit organizations, it's not for the staffed organizations, just any neighbors who want to come together to do a project. And how about if we just fund one-time projects, because the idea is to build capacity rather than create dependence? And how about if all the funding decisions are made by the neighborhood leaders themselves? Took this idea to City Council, very controversial. Why should we put any money into projects that aren't our priority? We don't have enough money for everything that is. Finally, at a vote of 5-4, they approved $150,000 for that first year. That first year, we supported 22 community self-help projects. They were so valued that the next year, our council voted unanimously to increase the fund to $1.5 million. Subsequently, increased to $4.5 million a year. Last year, we celebrated the 25th anniversary of the Neighborhood Matching Fund in Seattle. Over that time, there have been more than 5,000 community self-help projects completed across the city. The city's $60 million investment over the years has leveraged $85 million in community resources that under the old model, where people were looking to government to do everything, never would have been tapped. But the best value is it's newly involved tens of thousands of people in community life because we've finally given people a way to get involved other than going to meetings. And believe it or not, not everybody likes to go to meetings. With projects, unlike with meetings, there's always a result. It's a short-term commitment. There's a role for everybody. Young people, elders, people with disabilities, people who never go to meetings. Artists, construction workers, architects, everybody. And in the process, people build relationships. Once people build relationships, then they're more likely to go to some meetings. But we always lead with the meetings and wonder why the same people keep showing up, right? So I want to give you examples of some of the kinds of projects that come out of the matching fund. And you'll see so much innovation coming out of the matching fund that would never come out of the bureaucracy. So this is in our Ballard neighborhood. Again, our city has a population of 700,000 people, but our neighborhood's more like 5,000 people. So Ballard was a neighborhood that had the least number of street trees in any neighborhood outside of downtown Seattle. They also had the fewest number of parks. There was a woman there named Dervilla Gowan. She cared passionately about trees. She wanted to see trees up and down the streets. So she put notices in her church bulletin. She put them in the corner grocery store. She put them in the Ballard News Tribune, advertising for other people who shared her passion for street trees. She tried to find somebody in every block in Ballard who shared her passion. And if nobody came forward, she would go to that block and knock on every door until she convinced somebody they shared her passion for street trees. And then she got that person to sign a pledge form saying, I'll come to a training about how to plant, take care of the trees. I'll recruit my neighbors to do the same thing. She turned in all of her pledge forms with her matching fund application. One day, trucks pulled into her neighborhood with 1,080 trees. Dropped them off at every block in Ballard. Dervilla knocked on the door of the block captain and said, the trees are here. Block captain knocked on the neighbor's doors. That day, over 1,000 people came out, planted trees up and down the streets. People felt incredibly empowered. Beginning of the day, there's no street trees. The end of the day, tree-lined streets. They said, well, this is cool, but we still have the fewest number of parks of any neighborhood in Seattle. So they walked around the neighborhood looking for potential park sites. Had a hard time finding them because the neighborhood's pretty developed. But they finally found this old rundown house that used to serve as a nursery right next to the Crown Hill Business District. Huge public safety problem. They convinced the city to buy that property for a park. City had some open space bond money to buy the property, but absolutely no money to design or build the park. So the neighbors did it themselves. Local landscape architect volunteered her services and worked with the other neighbors, and together they designed and built Baker Park. There are some beautiful old trees in this park, and one of them had died. They're trying to figure out how to remove it, And then one of the neighbors, who was Native American, had a better idea. And he carved it in place as a totem. This group went on, and the next year, they tore up all the asphalt around the local school. Another example of innovation that comes out of community. Much better for the environment. Now the water can percolate through the soil rather than having instant runoff, and creates green space for the kids and for the neighbors. Now we do it around all our schools. But the innovation started in the community. This is the opening ceremony, and the Sedentary Sousa Band played for it. This is the group's most recent project. This is, again, the site of another former house. So to commemorate the house, they built all the furniture out of cement. And the dedication for this park, they unveiled a timeline that shows the 20 parks they built over the past 20 years. Every one of them with volunteers. They built ball fields. They built playgrounds. They worked with the kids to build a skate park. They're restoring a natural area. They're restoring the salmon estuary in the bay. 20 parks in 20 years, all volunteer. They said, this is great. We've made our neighborhood a much better place, but we're concerned about what's happening to the planet. We're concerned about climate change. So they organized an all-volunteer group called Sustainable Ballard. And every summer for the past 8 years, they've had a Sustainable Ballard Fest. They have music. They got food to draw people into the park. And then when people come, they have all kinds of booths to educate neighbors about what they can do to reduce their carbon footprint. And the first booth you go to is the undriver's license station, where you go and check all the ways you will not drive over the next month. And when you do, you get a laminated undriver's license. It's pretty cool. It's just like my official Washington State driver's license. So Julia Fields is the one who organized this. She says, I'm going to walk, I'm going to bike, I'm going to take transit, et cetera, et cetera. When you get your own driver's license, it entitles you to drive the shuffle bus. This is like a Fred Flintstone mobile, foot powered. It's going down the streets of Ballard, gets everybody's attention, gets people thinking, what could I do to get out of my car? What could I do to reduce my carbon footprint? This has created a movement now. All the neighborhoods around Ballard have organized their own all-volunteer sustainability groups. All the suburban communities around Seattle have done the same. We now have 67 of these all-volunteer organizations, and collectively they call themselves Scallops, sustainable communities all over Puget Sound. And it all started with Dervilla Gowan and those street trees 20 years ago. There's incredible untapped power in our communities, and I'm convinced it's the only way we're going to deal with climate change and a lot of the other big issues facing us. Every one of our playgrounds in Seattle, both in our parks and our schools, has been redeveloped by the community. Used to be, every one of our playgrounds looked exactly the same. I think our parks department got a good deal. Right? Now, each playground reflects what's special about that place and the people who live there. So this is the first playground to be developed in the Alki neighborhood. When they had their design meeting, some of the kids showed up in wheelchairs. And they said, we want to make sure every one of our kids can use this playground. So again, they built the first wheelchair-accessible playground in Seattle. Innovation coming out of community. This is in Carkeek Park in northwest Seattle, where the neighbors worked for 20 years to clean up Piper's Creek to make it better salmon habitat. They educated neighbors about not using fertilizers, not using pesticides. They built salmon weirs. They did revegetation along the creek. After 20 years of work, I got a call in the middle of the night from Nancy Momgren, who's a volunteer leader, said, Jim, the salmon are back. I raced across the city. It was the opposite side of the city. It got there, hundreds of people celebrating the return of the salmon because they all played a role in making that happen. They said, well, this is great. We got salmon back. Now we need to get kids into our park. We need a playground. So they had a design meeting, and one of the kids said, I want a salmon playground. And the adults are all scratching their heads. Nobody had ever seen a salmon playground before. But a local artist said, I got an idea. And he built a 19-foot-long salmon that's so big, you slide in the mouth and you come out the tail. And then you go into a cave and you climb over boulders. It gives kids a sense of the struggle that salmon go through to get back to the city of Seattle. So here's where you go in. It's pretty scary. Right? And you slide through and you land in a foam rubber sea. Not a project that would have come out of our parks department.
You're listening to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and rabble.ca/podcasts.
This is in our East Lake neighborhood. This is under our freeway. And underneath the freeway was good for nothing except holding it up. So there are all kinds of problems under there with illegal drug dealing, with illegal dumping. Young people went under there and said, this is the perfect place for something we've always wanted, but haven't been able to find the land for. A BMX track. What a great solution. It's always covered from the rain. Right? We can talk about the liability issues later. This is in the Fink neighborhood. Again, over and over again, we see examples of people reclaiming problem properties that have been owned by a silo department. In this case, the property is owned by the transportation department. This was platted as a street. There's houses on either side, but it was never developed because it's too steep. Cars could never make it to the top. As a result, it just sat and became a problem. It became overgrown, huge problem with rats. The only thing that tried to get up were four-wheel drive vehicles that come in the middle of the night, race their engines, challenge each other to make it to the top, drive the neighbors totally crazy. I thought the neighbors were nuts because they went out with picks and shovels, dug through that heavy hardpan clay soil by hand, hauled those timbers up the side, terraced that whole problem hillside, and turned that problem property into a community garden. This is now one of 85 organic community gardens we have in the city of Seattle, all built by neighbors. 7,000 urban gardeners. Collectively, they donate 3 tons of organic produce to our food banks every year. 20 of our most recent gardens are in public housing so that low-income, largely immigrant refugee population can grow food indigenous to their culture. In public housing, we also allow the residents to sell the produce to the larger community. It's a great way for them to make some income, great way to make cross-cultural connections, because oftentimes the people who are buying the produce have no idea what it is. So they share recipes, they do potlucks together. Food's a great way to bridge communities. We have a long waiting list, and we found that most of the people waiting to get into gardens were right downtown Seattle, where there's no new land downtown. So again, neighbors had a great idea. They said, you know, the parking garage at Seattle Center, where the Space Needle is, the top floor is only used 7 times a year for major events. We could make much better use of it as a garden. So they created a garden on the top floor of the parking garage. I just love the metaphor. You know the Joni Mitchell song? Pay paradise, put up a parking lot. This is the opposite. We're going in the right direction. It's a Beacon Hill neighborhood. They have 11 acres of property that's just owned by Seattle Public Utilities. It's not good for anything. It's just grass. So neighbors said, why don't we create an edible forest? So they're starting to do it. Here's the group that's starting to make that happen. And here's the beginnings of the edible forest, where they're going to have fruit trees, nut trees, berry bushes, and people can do gleaning right in the heart of Seattle. All kinds of facilities have been renovated through the Neighborhood Matching Fund. This is in the Alki neighborhood again, where they had a log cabin that was rotting away, and neighbors renovated that to become an historical museum. We don't just fund neighborhoods, we also fund communities of color, because particularly for new immigrants and refugees, they often identify because of common language, culture, with a cultural group before they identify with the place. So this is our Eritrean community that was concerned they're losing their kids to the streets. They used the matching funds to build their own cultural center. Been incredibly effective at bringing the kids back into their community. And the Duwamish tribe built a longhouse. They just dedicated that as a gathering place for their community. This is in the Soto neighborhood. This is the warehouse and industrial area just south of downtown Seattle. I wish I had the before picture because the backs of these warehouses were covered with graffiti. There was garbage all along the tracks. And this is a gateway into Seattle. This is the first view that tourists and commuters get of Seattle each day because this is how our light rail comes in. It was a terrible view of Seattle. Mike Perringer here worked in the local factory. He says, I got a great idea. Why don't we see the backs of these warehouses as potential canvases for murals? He called it the Urban Art Corridor. But Mike had an even better idea. He worked with our court system, and he asked the judges, could you offer the kids who get busted for graffiti an alternative sentence, where they could come and help us to create the murals? Not an easy decision for the kids. It's like a job. You have to show up at work on time, dress appropriately, you get life skills training, mentored by professional artists. But young people create every one of these murals. And we found that as long as the kids were involved in this program, not one of them reoffended. The problem in Seattle is you can only paint outdoor murals 3 months a year because it's raining the other 9 months. So Mike came up with another great idea and got a local warehouse to donate their space. And in there, they create murals on 4 million sheets of plywood. They put those around construction sites to beautify the construction sites. The developers pay for the murals, and it keeps the program sustainable over time. All kinds of public art's been done through the Neighborhood Matching Fund. This is in our international district, where we really have four different communities that are often warring over what's called the neighborhood. There's a Little Saigon, there's a Chinatown, there's a Japantown, there's a Manila town. They finally all came together and said, we all have dragons that are common to our culture, but they're a little different from each other. So let's come together and create a composite dragon. So they have 17 dragons climbing up the utility poles all over the district. Now they call it the International District. Finally, here's a project in the Fremont neighborhood. Another bridge. Huge problems, because underneath the bridge was good for nothing except holding it up. So again, problems with drug dealing, with illegal dumping. Fremont's got lots of artists. They went under this bridge and they said, this is kind of cool space. It's almost like a cathedral. It's got this high ceiling, big columns. They started calling it the Hall of Giants. Second year of the matching fund, the program was still very controversial. They came and said, we'd like to get $24,600 so we can put some public art under the bridge. I said, cool, what's it going to be? They said, we don't know yet. Once we get the money, then we're going to put out a call for artists, and we're going to let the people vote on what they want under the bridge. I said, man, we can't fund that. We don't even know what it is. That'd be the end of the matching fund. But as I said, neighborhood leaders make all the funding decisions, and they like this idea, so they agreed to fund it. I thought, oh my God, there goes the matching fund. So they got the money, they put out a call for artists. Artists submitted different models for what they wanted under the bridge. Somebody submitted a large throne because they were calling it the Hall of Giants. Somebody else submitted larger-than-life construction workers and engineers, kind of a tribute to the people who built the bridge. Somebody else submitted a troll. I thought, oh my God, how would I explain to the mayor that we're going to use public funds to build a troll under a bridge? We don't even have enough money to fix all the potholes. That'll definitely be the end of the matching fund. So they put these models on display at the Fremont Fair. 100,000 people come. Everybody comes by the booth, is entitled to vote for which sculpture they want under the bridge. I kept going by voting for those construction workers because I figured they're the least objectionable. Guess which one won? Yeah, my worst fear. And it got a whole lot worse. Because a couple days later, the art critic from the Daily Newspaper wrote a scathing review. She says, this shows that people should never be involved in public art decisions. This is kitsch. It's a terrible waste of public funds. I thought, oh my God, there goes the matching fund. But her column so incensed the community. They started rallying behind the troll. They started doing street dances to raise money for the troll. The kids wrote a troll rap. I went to the neighborhood one day. There were 10-foot-long footprints up and down the streets of Fremont like the troll had been walking through the neighborhood. So they raised the money. They built the troll. Here he is. That troll is so big, that's a real VW. There was some vandalism early on. Somebody broke out the window in the VW. How'd the neighbors respond? They organized a troll patrol. They put lighting on the troll. They walk around the troll in the neighborhood every night, making sure the troll and the neighborhood are safe. And that's what happens when people start to take ownership of their communities again. They don't just call up the city and say, hey, there's problems with your troll. It's their troll. They watch after it. And they're always programming the troll. They do Shakespeare on the troll. At Halloween, they celebrate Trolloween in Fremont, and everybody comes dressed, and they thousands of people come. They howl at the troll, and they do processions through the streets. At Christmas time, all Santa Claus is gathered there. They just celebrate the 20th birthday of the troll. And when people come, they shop in the local business district, and there's always legitimate activity underneath the bridge, so there's absolutely no problems with public safety. Not a solution that would have come out of our police department, right? Huge public safety problem under the bridge. Let's bring in the troll. I don't think so. Yeah. So as you can see, practically anything goes with the Neighborhood Matching Fund. Just really lends itself to creativity, community energy. Well, they said, well, this is great, but if you really wanted to give us the power, if you really wanted to empower communities, you'd empower us to do more than single projects. You'd empower us to actually create our own plans for our community. Think about how what's the future of our community? In Fremont, they worked really hard to make it a cool place. And they made it so cool, the artists can't afford to live there anymore. So how do we plan longer term for our communities? How do we make sure we don't have gentrification? So the third major paradigm shift the government needs to make is, instead of always driving the agenda, to support community-driven initiatives. And the way we did that is we created a neighborhood planning program in Seattle. And we told neighborhoods, if you can bring all of the different interest groups in the neighborhood together and have a plan for engaging everybody else, we'll give you money to hire your own planner that's accountable to the community. And you can plan for whatever's important to you. When our city did plans, they were usually land use plans. And there's nothing more controversial than a land use plan, particularly when it's divorced from everything else. When the community planned, they often planned for public safety, economic development, affordable housing, arts and culture, transportation, open space. Usually it was all of those things, because in communities, everything comes together. So the first time we started getting comprehensive plans, where it used to be every department kind of created their own plans. One plan for parks, one for transportation, one for land use, one for, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I just want to show how this played out in one neighborhood, in my neighborhood of Columbia City. In Columbia City, we involved hundreds and hundreds of people in the planning process. And one of the key recommendations out of our neighborhood plan was, we've got the highest percentage of kids of any neighborhood in Seattle. But because it's a poor community, very multicultural community, hasn't had the kind of voice that some of the other neighbors have had in the past in terms of lobbying the city. So we still don't have a community center. We want a community center. Because we involved so many people in the planning process, we had a lobby. And we're able to convince the city to put up the money for the new community center. My wife, as a volunteer, organized a girls' softball league because there was no recreation for girls in the community. Got it all organized. The kids were all excited. Then we realized there were no free ball fields. They're all being used by the guys. So we started building our own ball fields using the parents and the kids. And out of our planning process, this became a priority. So the community came together and we built ball fields all over the community. So part of my point here is that neighborhood planning is a way to hold government accountable so the plans don't just sit on the shelf like so many plans do, where the only person who owns the plans is the planner. But it's also about how do we get the community to take some responsibility themselves, because there's some things communities can do. Another priority was, how can we open up our school for community use? I don't know if it's true here, but in Seattle, our schools are used about 18% of the time, because the mission of the school is to educate young people. And when it's not being used to educate young people, it sits vacant. School's not used at night, not used weekends, not during the summer, not during holidays, 18% of the time. How many factories could afford to operate their fiscal plan 18% of the time? Now, our city government worked for years trying to get the schools to open up, because they got all kinds of great facilities. But the city government couldn't get the school district to do it. It's a different jurisdiction. But it's something the community was able to get them to do, because the community was the same electorate for the school district as it was for the city. So they were able to get the school board members to say, yeah, we'll follow your neighborhood plan. We'll open up the school at night for community use. So here's our former mayor, Norm Rice, opening up the school. We call it Powerful Schools. In the classrooms, neighborhood volunteers teach their skills for free to other community members. You can go in there and learn just about any language. My wife and daughter took a class together in sign language. There's a, you can take a course in how to repair your bicycle, how to do organic gardening, all kinds of stuff. There's a computer center where low-income kids are teaching their parents how to use a computer. Cafeteria where you do community meals together. A library, an auditorium for community performances. Gymnasium for community recreation. And we tore up the asphalt around the school and put in raised beds, so we have community gardens. And then the community gets involved in school during the daytime. Every kid has a powerful buddy, somebody who's mentoring them, tutoring them. We bring in arts, we bring in music, we bring in powerful writers, all community resources that we're contributing to the school. The other huge issue in the neighborhood at the time was our business district. We had, just as the heart of every other neighborhood, we had a business district there. And soon after I moved into the neighborhood, that business district started to go downhill. I like to think it wasn't just because of me, that it's the same thing that's happening to Main Street everywhere, where because of big box retail, the malls, we're losing our Main Streets everywhere. So one at a time, we started losing our businesses. We lost our hardware store, we lost our pharmacy, we lost the furniture store, we lost both of the clothing stores. As more and more of the storefronts became boarded up, we got more and more crime in the business district. Drug dealing, prostitution, gang activity. As we got more and more crime, most of the rest of the businesses moved out. We finally lost our theater, we lost our supermarket. So out of our neighborhood plan, the community said, we're gonna revitalize our business district. And they organized a town meeting to use the oldest trick in the world. They said, we'll give you free breakfast if you come to our town meeting. And we had the Filipino restaurant, which is the largest space we could find in the business district, and told people, come with your ideas for a project that will make Columbia City a better neighborhood. And everybody who had an idea got to stand up in front and present their idea for a minute or two and try to convince other people to join them. And then when everybody presented their ideas, we put them up in butcher paper in front of the room. And then you know what happens, right? Everybody gets their dots, and you put your dots in your favorite ideas. Then at the end of the planning exercise, we count up the number of dots, and we put it in a planning document, and we put it in a file, and we never see it again. Have you been there? That's why so many people are turned off to this whole community engagement stuff. We said that's not what's going to happen in this case. The only way any of these things is going to happen is if you take responsibility for it. So if you like this idea, you better stand up and champion it and convince other people to join you. So everybody who likes this first idea, follow the person who suggested it right now, go to the Columbia Baptist Church, start working on it. Got the rest of the morning. Everybody who likes this idea, go to the library, start working on it. Everybody who likes this idea, go to the Thai restaurant, start working on it. Vote with your feet. Go where your passion is. Amazingly, so many projects happened out of that first town meeting. We came back the next year to celebrate those projects and kick off another round. We've now been doing this for 17 years. So I just want to show you some examples of what came out of it. First town meeting, somebody said, we've got this Derigold plant coming in, a big dairy plant, gateway into the neighborhood, covered with graffiti, sends a very negative statement about our neighborhood. He said, I just moved here from Mexico, I'm a muralist, I'll create a mural if everybody will help me paint it. So we had dozens of people on the scaffolding painting what we love about our neighborhood, its multicultural heritage. Somebody said, we've got a Christian Science church that's been boarded up for years, let's renovate that and make it a cultural center. So now we have performances there, young people being trained in theater, in the arts, and we have performances every weekend. When people come to hear the performances, they shop in the local business district. They go to the local restaurants. Somebody said, we're never going to get businesses back into the business district unless we make it look better. He said, I work for the Port of Seattle. I'll get them donate a shipping container. We'll put a mural on the outside, fill the inside up with cleaning equipment, and on the weekends, volunteers came to clean up the business district, painting out the graffiti, sweeping sidewalks, clipping the overgrowth. Somebody had a great idea. So we still have a few restaurants left, but they're afraid to open up at night. They just serve lunch because of all the crime at night. Why don't we get different ethnic music in each restaurant on a Friday night and allow people to go from restaurant to restaurant and listen to music? Called the idea Beat Walk. Had a really hard time talking the business owners into this idea because they hadn't had a good experience at night. They finally agreed, and the first Beat Walk, the streets were just lined with legitimate activity. People were so excited. And the business owners begged and said, could we do this again next month? We've now been doing it every month. And the number of venues just keeps growing. Talked about how we'd lost our supermarket. Somebody said, let's see that as an opportunity. We have that huge parking lot that's sitting there. Let's start up a farmer's market. So volunteers organize a farmer's market. And Wednesday nights, we get 2,500 people out for the farmer's market. Again, when they come, they shop in the local business district. Here are kids from the local school selling their plant starts at the farmer's market. I wish I had the before picture of this. This was the most run-down storefront in the business district. Somebody said, let's fix up the worst facade. Maybe get the other business owners to fix theirs up. Somebody said, that won't do any good unless we get a business inside. Somebody said, how about a bike shop? Somebody else said, how about a nonprofit bike store? So volunteers renovated this building, Seattle Bike Works. People donated their used bicycles that hadn't worked for years. And they teach at-risk youth how to fix the bicycles. And every kid who graduates from the program earns his or her own bicycle. They've now formed a bicycle club, so they do regular bike rides around the neighborhood. The older kids do the Seattle to Portland bike ride. They've now fixed so many bicycles that hundreds of kids have earned their own. They donate bicycles to homeless families, to foster kids. They're sending bicycles to people of Africa every year. This is out of a neighborhood that was seen as a place with nothing but needs. Well, let's fight all these projects. There were so many more. There was one block in this historic district we couldn't get any businesses to come into. We kept trying to market it. Nobody would come. Finally, somebody said, look, if we can't get real businesses, let's pretend. So what kind of business would you like? Somebody said, I want an ice cream store. So we painted the boarded up doors and windows to make it look like there was an ice cream store. People say, well, that's cool, but I want a bookstore, and I want a toy store, and I want a dance studio. I want a hat shop. So we painted that entire block to make it look like there were businesses. People got excited. Cars were stopping. People wanted to get out and shop. Within a year, we had to take down every one of these murals because real businesses wanted to get in on the action. So this is what it looks like 1 year later, with an Italian deli, with a brew pub, with a co-op art gallery that also came out of a town meeting. You go to Columbia City today, there's not one empty storefront. They're building new mixed-use development to keep up with demand. And everything that happened here, built on the community's ideas, built on the neighborhood plan, the community's ideas, using the community's resources. Incredible untapped potential in our communities. So here's what I see as the value of community-driven planning. That implementation actually happens. The plans don't just sit on the shelf. Resources are multiplied. The government's resources leverage to the communities. Appropriate development occurs, respecting the unique character of the neighborhood and culture of the community, unlike the one-size-fits-all standardized approaches that often come top-down. More holistic and innovative solutions result as we get out of the silos. And a stronger sense of community is built as the different factions in the community come together around a shared vision. So I've talked a lot about Seattle, but what I want to emphasize is the same thing is happening absolutely everywhere, all over the world. I'm doing work everywhere now. And I think because of the economic crisis, because of the crisis around democracy, and because of the crisis around climate change, and because government are recognizing that the old ways haven't worked that well. We spent more and more money in safety programs that people are feeling less safe than ever. We spent more and more money on anti-poverty programs and the income gap just keeps growing. We spent more and more money on environmental programs and we're closer and closer to climate change. Recognizing there's a role for community. And citizens are starting to realize that as well. And I think it's been harder here because you have much better government than we have in the States. So over time, I think people started to think, hey, my job is to pay my taxes, and government's job is to take care of me. And you shouldn't take that for granted. That's fantastic. You got to hold on to that. But people are also starting to recognize that government can't do everything. And there's some things best done by community and some things best done in partnership. So that's changing all over the world. In Brazil, participatory budgeting, where they're developing budgets from the neighborhood on up. The whole budget's being developed through a program of popular participation. And now that model is being utilized in Chicago, in New York City, in a number of places in the UK. In India, they have village assemblies all over. In many ways, Brazil and India are way ahead of the rest of us in terms of doing democracy. In Japan, I was Kobe's a sister city. I was right there after the earthquake. After that earthquake, they realized there's absolutely no substitute for community. And they started up a community building movement all over Japan that continues to this day. In Taiwan, I got to speak at the graduation of hundreds of young people who are graduating as young community planners. Young people are volunteering to be leaders in their communities. And where they have community empowerment centers in every major city. In New Zealand, there's a huge movement called community-led development. In many ways, it's following the language and the concepts of the Maoris. It's really exciting. Lots of bottom-up planning, lots of community initiatives all over New Zealand. Small towns, the city of Auckland's been a leader in this. In Australia, I've got a keynote, a conference with Peter Kenyon called Power to the People. And this is for the Trade Association for all the local governments. How refreshing to have locally elected officials realize that democracy is one of their functions. Right? It's not just about roads, not just about police. It's about the people. It's about democracy. I was in the Netherlands. They have a whole movement there called Burgerkrot. Citizen power. And it's happening absolutely everywhere. It's just amazing. To all kinds of projects. Peel and Moss, the bottom-up planning. Hogevane, where they're doing participatory budgeting. This is a social housing community in Zutphen. And they took over one of the units and turned it into a community center, all but run by resident volunteers. Their flags, the name of the social housing community is Berkel Park. People always look down on it. Their flag says Berkel Park, full of talent. And the United Kingdom gave a couple talks at 10 Downing Street. They're replicating our neighborhood matching fund across the entire country with £120 million. They're training 5,000 community organizers. They're realizing when times are tough, they should be investing more money in the community because that's where the resources are. But when I spoke at 10 Downing Street, I reminded them that this is great. You're seeing the role for community, but you know there's also a role for government. This isn't a way to cut back government and have volunteers come in and do what government workers used to do. The real value of community is doing things in a different way. And the same thing is happening in Canada. I spend more time in Canada than any place else. I was just in Hamilton. They're doing lots of bottom-up planning in Hamilton. They did participatory budgeting in Hamilton. I was in some neighborhoods that did bottom-up planning. I was in one neighborhood, and they showed me some problem properties in their neighborhood, very low-income community. I said, so what are you doing about those? Are you filing complaints with the city? No, we're helping our neighbors fix them up because they don't have the resources. I was in another neighborhood. They said we wanted to create a community hub. The old school is going to be sold off by the school district. So we mortgaged our homes. Five homeowners mortgaged their homes to make the down payment. That's incredible commitment to their community. In Edmonton, in Victoria, all over Canada, this stuff's happening. And it's happening right here in Halifax. I just heard some fantastic stories about the farmers markets, about painting the intersections, about community gardens. All kinds of great stuff happening here in Halifax, and we don't get those stories out enough. We need to get those stories out to spread more of this. My final word is, I know this is really tough work. It's hard. I make it sound easy. I talked about 25 years of work in Seattle in a few minutes. It's not that easy. It took a long time. It takes a while to build. And sometimes we wonder, what difference are we making? Working so hard, just trying to fix up our neighborhood. And meanwhile, there's these huge global issues around the economy, around war, around climate change. But the reason I wanted to share all these stories is I want you to let you know you're not alone. And the work you're doing is happening in all corners of the world. We've got a huge community building movement happening absolutely everywhere. And I think together, we're going to make change. We are making change. So I just want to give you words of encouragement to keep on, keep pushing. Push your government to be more responsive. Get back to democracy. Get back to the role of the community. But don't wait for them either. Just start doing stuff. People in Canada are a little bit shy. Need some permission. Just do it. It's your community. Take it back. So thanks so much.
You've been listening to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and ravel.ca/podcasts. Got feedback on the show? Call the CKDU feedback line at 494-8041 or email habitat@ckdu.ca or check us out on Twitter @habitatradio. I'm Erica Butler. Thanks for listening.